Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about a weapon that skipped across the water like a flat stone off a farm pond, and I want to tell you about the men who had to fly straight and level at night at 60 feet into a wall of tracer fire to make it work. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Taildragger, and this is the Hangar, where we sit with a cup of coffee and talk about the airplanes and the people who made this whole business what it is. Today we go back to a spring night in 1943, over the industrial heart of Germany. Now, before we roll the reel back, let me tell you who keeps the lights on around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friends, the story we're telling today is exactly the kind of thing those coins are meant to honor. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So let's set the scene, the Ruhr Valley. It was the forge of the German war machine, steel mills, factories, foundries, all of them thirsty for two things, electricity and water, and that water and power came from a handful of enormous dams holding back reservoirs up in the hills. The biggest of them was the Mona. Another was the Eder, great curved walls of masonry, some of them 130 feet thick at the base, holding back millions of tons of water. The planners in Britain had been staring at those dams for years. Everybody understood that if you could crack one of those walls, you'd send a wall of water roaring down the valley, drown the factories, knock out the power, wash out the railways. But there was a problem, a big one. You cannot break a dam like that with an ordinary bomb.
Drop it in the water in front of the dam, and the water cushions the blast. Drop it on top, and you just chip the crown. To actually shatter one of those walls, you'd have to lay a very large charge right up against the face of the dam, deep under the water, so the reservoir itself would trap the explosion and drive it straight into the masonry. Like a depth charge, hugging the concrete. And there was no way in the world to do that. The Germans knew the dams were tempting, so they'd strung heavy anti-torpedo nets across the reservoirs. Any torpedo you fired would tangle in the nets long before it ever reached the wall. Now here's where it gets interesting. There was an engineer named Barnes Wallace, quiet fellow, wire-rimmed glasses, the look of a schoolmaster. He'd already designed airframes and airships, but this problem got hold of him and would not let go. And Wallace got to thinking about skipping stones. You've done it. Every one of us has stood at the edge of a lake and thrown a flat rock sidearm and watched it dance across the surface. Skip, 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 Wallace thought. What if a bomb could do that? What if you could throw a drum-shaped charge out ahead of the airplane, spinning, and let it bounce along the top of the water, right over the torpedo nets until it smacked into the face of the dam? Then, with the last of its momentum spent, it would crawl down the wall as it sank, and a hydrostatic fuse would set it off at exactly the right depth, 30 feet down, against the concrete. The reservoir would do the rest. People thought he was out of his mind. But Wallace started testing. He fired marbles across a tub of water in his garden. He talked the authorities into letting him drop test shapes off the coast, and he found the trick that made the whole thing work. Backspin. You had to spin the drum backward, about 500 revolutions a minute, before you released it. The backspin kept it skipping true, kept it from veering off, and when it hit the dam, it actually helped hug the bomb to the wall as it sank instead of drifting away. He'd cracked the physics, but physics was the easy part.
Because now think about what you're asking a bomber crew to do. To make that bomb skip properly, you couldn't just toss it out from altitude. The drum had to leave the airplane at precisely the right height above the water, at precisely the right speed, at precisely the right distance from the dam. Too high and it would shatter on impact instead of skipping. Too low and it would dig in and sink. The number they settled on was 60 feet above the black water of a reservoir, at night, at about 232 miles an hour, in a four-engine heavy bomber the size of a barn. Let me put that in terms a pilot can feel. 60 feet is lower than most of us have ever flown on purpose outside of a runway, that's below the treetops on the shoreline. That's low enough that a moment's inattention, a twitch of the yoke, a bump of turbulence, and you're in the water with no time to recover, and you had to hold that altitude, dead steady, while men on the ground shot at you with everything they had. The airplane they gave the job to was the Avro Lancaster. Now, the Lancaster is one of the great warbirds, and I get a little misty talking about her. Four Rolls-Royce Merlin engines. That deep, throaty growl a Merlin makes, the same music you hear from a Spitfire, but four times over. A big, honest, willing airplane.
They stripped these particular Lancasters down, cut away the bomb bay doors, and slung the great spinning drum underneath on a special cradle with a little motor to spin it up before the drop, and they formed a brand new squadron, just for this. 617 Squadron,
handpicked crews, some of the most experienced men in Bomber Command, and a lot of them barely old enough to vote. Their commander was a 24-year-old named Guy Gibson, a young man who'd already flown more operations than most men see in a lifetime. They didn't even know what the target was at first. They just knew they had to learn to fly lower than anybody had ever flown, and hold it there night after night over the lakes of England, practicing until it became instinct. Which brings me to my favorite piece of the whole story, the altitude problem.
How on earth do you know you're exactly 60 feet above black water in the dark? Your altimeter is worthless that low. It reads off barometric pressure, and it's not accurate enough, and the pressure over a mountain reservoir isn't the pressure the thing was set to anyway. You cannot eyeball 60 feet over water at night. The surface is a mirror. Pilots have flown perfectly good airplanes straight into calm water because they had no depth cue at all. So somebody, and the story goes it came out of a night at the theater watching the spotlights play across the stage, had a beautifully simple idea. They mounted two spotlights on the Lancaster, one up front, one further back in the belly. And they aimed them down and inward so the two beams would cross, would meet at a single point at exactly 60 feet below the airplane. So the navigator would lean out and watch the water, and when the two little pools of light slid together into one figure eight on the surface, the pilot knew, without an instrument, without a doubt, that he was at 60 feet. Two spots became one. Hold it there. Isn't that something? All that engineering, the backspin, the hydrostatic fuse, the skipping physics, and the thing that finally solved the last piece was two flashlights and a schoolboy's geometry. They still needed the distance to the dam figured out, and they solved that just as simply, a little wooden, handheld sight, like a slingshot, with two nails on the ends. When the two towers on top of the dam lined up with the two nails, you were the right distance out. Release now. Now let me take you to the night itself. The 16th into the 17th of May, 1943. 19 Lancasters took off in the darkness. They went in three waves, out across the North Sea and into occupied Europe, flying so low that crews later swore they came home with treetops and telegraph wires in the airplane. They flew under the German radar because they flew under everything. One airplane hit the sea and tore its bomb clean off. Another struck power lines. Men died on the way in before they ever saw a dam, because that's what 60 feet in the dark costs you. Gibson's wave reached the Moni first. Picture it. That great curved wall, pale in the moonlight, the reservoir stretching away black behind it, and on the towers, anti-aircraft guns waiting. Gibson pushed the nose down, brought his Lancaster right down onto the water, lined up the towers in his little wooden sight, and ran straight at the guns while his gunners fired back, and the bomb aimer called it steady, steady. The drum spun up underneath, the spotlights kissed together on the water, release. The first bomb skipped and hit, and the wall held. The second Lancaster ran in and was hit hard and went down. Men lost. And here's the thing about Gibson I want you to remember. On the runs that followed, he flew his own airplane alongside the attacking bomber, drawing the guns onto himself so the man making the drop would have a clearer shot at the target. Think about the kind of nerve that takes you've already survived your run. You could sit back, and instead you fly back into the fire again and again to soak up the tracer so your friend has a chance. It took several runs, and then the Moni Dam broke. The crew circling above described a sight none of them ever forgot, the moon on the water, and then the wall simply giving way, and a wall of water bursting through the gap, a torrent so violent that Gibson said the valley below turned to a sheet of moving silver as the flood rolled down toward the factories. They radioed the code word back to England, and part of the force turned and pressed on to the Eder Dam, tucked down in a steep, twisting valley so tight the pilots had to dive, drop, and haul the Lancaster up over a mountain on the far side, all in a matter of seconds. And they broke the Eder too. Of the 19 airplanes that set out, 8 did not come home. 53 young men were killed. That's a brutal price, and I don't ever want to gloss over it. These were somebody's sons. Now, the honest history, what did it actually accomplish? The floods did real damage. Factories drowned. Power stations knocked out. Hundreds of people killed on the ground, including prisoners and forced laborers in a camp downstream, which is part of the hard truth of it. The Germans threw enormous resources into repairs, and being Germans, they patched the Moni back up faster than the Allies expected. The war did not end because of one night over the Ruhr. It rarely works that way. But here's what the raid really did, and it's the part that lasts. It proved that a precisely aimed weapon, delivered by a small force with extraordinary skill, could do a job that thousands of ordinary bombs could not. It was the birth of what we'd now call precision attack. And it was a shot of pure defiance at a moment when Britain badly needed to believe such a thing was possible. 617 Squadron earned a name that night that they carried to this very day, the Dambusters.
and I'll tell you what stays with me, as a pilot. Strip away the war for a second, what those crews did was a flying achievement of the highest order. To hold a heavy airplane at 60 feet, in the dark, dead steady, while the world tries to kill you, and to release a spinning bomb at exactly the right instant so it dances across the water and does what a garden tub experiment said it would. That is airmanship. That is stick and rudder skill and cold nerve welded together. We practice steep turns and short fields and pat ourselves on the back. Those boys flew that. Barnes Wallace, the quiet engineer, was said to have wept when he learned how many crews didn't return. He never forgot it. A good man carrying the weight of a good idea. For the details tonight, I leaned on the Royal Air Force's own histories of 617 Squadron, the accounts left behind by the men who flew it, and the long record of Barnes Wallace's own testing that survives in the British Archives and the Imperial War Museum. If you ever get the chance to stand next to a Lancaster, and there are only a couple left flying in the whole world, go do it. Stand under those four Merlins and imagine them at 60 feet in the dark. You can find us anytime at RadioHangar.com.
60 feet, two spotlights, and a stone skipped across the water. Some nights the impossible thing gets done by the folks brave enough and precise enough to try it. Fly safe out there.